Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Well, I hope you enjoyed your bank holiday weekend. It's all over now. Back to work tomorrow for a lot of people. A lot of people working from home, of course. Anyway, a busy show ahead of us tonight. Niall Hatch in studio with me, Richard Collins at his home in Malahide. And we'll be hearing from Terry Flanagan, who was at Photo Wildlife Park, where he met the new director, the old director. When I say old, I don't mean old as in years, but the former director, Sean McKeown, has recently retired. So we raise our glasses to you, Sean McKeown, as the cast did on Coronation Street in 1987 when Hilda Ogden bowed out. Slauncha! We leave Hilda. Now, Richard Collins, I want to talk to you about Namibia. You've been there, haven't you?
I have indeed, Derek. A most interesting country, a fascinating country.
Why?
Well, it's quite unusual. The name comes from the Namib, said to be the oldest desert in the world. And by Jove, is it a desert. It's sand stretching to infinity. Now, it's on the Atlantic coast. It is slightly northwest of South Africa. Mm-hmm. There's less than 3 million people in Namibia, but it is about 10 times the size of Ireland. So it gives you an idea. But now the coast stretches for well over 1,000 miles. And the north of that is known as the Skeleton Coast because so many ships have been wrecked on it. And as you go along it, you see a wreck every few hundred metres, whatever. Seabirds nesting on it, cormorants and gulls and things like this. Inland, then, you have this marvellous desert which blends into the Kalahari, which is further east, and it has enormous dunes, the highest sand dunes in Africa, as high as the Dublin Mountains, not quite as high as the Wicklow Mountains. They are just enormous, with these cacti sticking up, as the most evocative thing. And then you have the Cape Cross Seal Colony. The Cape Cross Seal Colony has an enormous number of seals in it. Some say as many as 100,000
wow.
Seals. It is an extra, and of course it's got varied wildlife of all kinds. And then at the top you have Etosha, one of the great national parks of the world. Namibia has the largest number of black rhinos, wild black rhinos, found anywhere.
But did you see any hippos when you were there?
I didn't,
because
it's very thin on rivers. There is a river on the north, but I wasn't on that river. I've seen hippos in all sorts of places, but I didn't see any in Namibia.
Right,
but
because an old friend of the programme, Neil Beddy, who's an Irish conservationist based out in Africa, he's now in Namibia. He was in South Africa, but he's moved recently. And he sent me a video the other day. You can hear it there, and you can hear a boat going very fast through the water. And you can see off in the distance there what just looks like some rocks in the water. And as they get closer and closer, you can see the rocks are moving. Oh my goodness, what's going on? They're moving. It looks like, is it a herd of hippos? It looks like there are hundreds of them. You've seen that video, Richard.
Yes, I have. And you do see that. I remember seeing that in other African rivers. They gather together because, I think probably, because the babies are very vulnerable. A baby hippo is born on land and it's taken by its mother into the water. When it's in the herd, it is safe. The crocodiles can't get at it. As it gets older, then it's able to fend for itself and it can risk life on its own. But it is an extraordinary animal. It has got wonderful defences. The name, of course, is the water horse, hippopotamus. It's not a bit like a horse to look at, but it is a vegetarian, just as a horse is. They are aquatic animals. They can shut down their nostrils and their ears when they go underwater so that the water doesn't get in. The bones are heavy to help them sink. The legs are short because they don't need to be big and strong when the animal is buoyant in the water.
They spend an awful lot of time in water, something like 16 hours of the day in water. You'd wonder why they'd bother coming on land at all if they spend that much time in water, because I'm sure people have the opposite view of them, that they spend most of their time on land, but that's not true.
And then the head is enormous and the mouth is enormous. It's a very dangerous animal.
I'm sure it is. Well, and it's only dangerous if you're threatening it. I mean, otherwise it's minding its own business, I assume. Have you ever seen one, Niall?
I have. I've seen them in South Africa in the Kruger National Park. And they definitely deserve some respect. It's one that people are frightened of because you might not think you're threatening it, but they do feel threatened. So anywhere you'd see like a ford in a river, they're very careful there in case the hippopotamus lurking, because it could get a fright. It could rear up and stampede or trample you or bite you. And I believe that they are responsible for more deaths of people in Africa than lions or leopards are. They are considered very dangerous. So that you certainly want to give them a wide berth. Also, although they spend most of their time in water taking advantage of that buoyancy that will help to disperse their weight, when they're on land, they can move faster than you would expect. They can run really fast in short bursts if they need to. So it's an animal that you need to treat with respect.
For sure. Now, before we move on, I want to play a clip from an interview conducted by my colleague Michelle Brown with Lisa Clancy near Gorton, County Galway. Lisa, believe it or not, is an insect portrait photographer and ecologist, and she's compiling a book with her beautiful artwork. She's also putting together some little bits of narrative to tell us about some of the fascinating behaviours of insects. Now, Michelle produces a series for RTE Radio called The Custodians of Ireland, and Lisa featured this afternoon. Have a listen.
I have another one.
Go on.
So it's the large blue. It was critically, it actually went extinct in Britain in 1979. They've had a really successful conservation project and it's come back. It doesn't occur in Ireland, but a cousin of it occurs here, the common blue, but it has this incredible life cycle. So at around 2 to 3 weeks, when it wants to become an adult, it times its fall off its host plant to coordinate when ants are most active, so about 6 p.m. in the evening. And then this hour-long ritual ensues with the ants. So the ants will feed this, the caterpillar kind of excretes this sugary syrup, the ants will feed off it, and then the caterpillar assumes this kind of humped shape. And for whatever reason then, it's thought maybe the ants mistake it for an ant larva. They lift the caterpillar up, take it back to its nest, and put it into the brood chamber where all the ant larvae are. The caterpillar then kind of, it leaves the brood chamber, and in an outer chamber, it weaves this silk pad up in the ceiling, and it'll stay there for 10 months until it becomes an adult. But at night, when the nurse ants are gone, the caterpillar will come down out of the little tent into the brood chamber and binge feed on the ant larva. And then after 10 months, it'll develop into an adult, and keeping its wings pinned down, it'll scurry out of the ant nest and fly off for the first time. It has to be very clever, because if it binge feeds and eats too much of the ant larva, the ants will freak out, leave the nest. And there could be other large brood caterpillars pulling the similar scam. So they kind of all have to coordinate. And that's such a really specific, teeny tiny ecological niche, is why they're so threatened. But like I said, I think they preserved a particular type of meadowland, and they had a few other initiatives in Britain. And I heard in 2022, numbers are thriving, which is so heartwarming to hear. Because, I mean, like I said, it went extinct. So I think it's a small miracle that anyone found out that that's even happening. I mean, how do you find that out? To know what's going on inside ant nests, I think, is incredible.
On the shoulders of giants, Lisa, is all I can say to that wonderful programme. And we'll put a link to that Custodians of Ireland series on our website. And later I'll be telling you about another programme which we broadcast on RT Radio 1 from our Nature on One series, which was presented by Niall, and that was all about birds' eggs. But back to you now, Niall. Speaking of rare species, you were in Gran Canaria a couple of weeks ago in search of the blue chaffinch, if I'm not mistaken.
You've got it spot on there, Derek. Yes, the Gran Canaria blue chaffinch, to be specific. It's one of the rarest birds in the world. It's a bird that when I was a teenager poring through all of my bird books, I never thought I would get the chance to see it. It was a thought it could actually even be extinct, or certainly headed for extinction. The numbers were so low. It's a bird that is only found on the island of Gran Canaria. And it's a bird that is completely confined on that island just to certain pockets of native endemic Canarian pine, only found in the Canary Islands. There's another species of blue chaffinch related to it that is found on Tenerife, the neighbouring island, but the two are quite different, and it's been realised in recent years that they actually are a separate species. And then to compound the confusion, there's another chaffinch on the islands, the Canary Islands chaffinch, which is more closely related to our common chaffinch here in Europe, but it's also a separate species, and you find it in the same sort of habitat. So it is a bit confusing. But for those who are familiar with the chaffinch that you might get at your bird table,
quite colourful.
Colourful bird, yeah, absolutely, especially the male. The male has this lovely blue on the head, all right, but then that's the extent of the blue. The face and the chest is a lovely sort of pinkish red. The back is a very rich chestnut brown. The bit of the back that's covered by the folded wings is bright green. So when the chaffinch flies away, the green flashes off from what you'll first notice. And then it has wonderful black and white patterning in the wings and in the tail. The Gran Canaria blue chaffinch, it has the same general body shape, that slightly peaked crest and stubby bill that a chaffinch here would have, but it doesn't have any of those reds or anything on it. It's considerably bigger than our chaffinch. No red on it, just blue all over the body, and it's a more paler greyish blue on the chest, and it has white stripes in the wing, a double white wing bar, which is one of the best ways to separate it from its close relative, the Tenerife blue chaffinch on that neighbouring island.
Now, you recorded an interview while you were out there, Niall.
I did. I had the great pleasure of teaming up with a wonderful gentleman called Guillermo Bernal there. Guillermo has worked for several years on this Gran Canaria blue chaffinch project that's funded by the European Union, and it was with his help that I managed to see the birds. We saw six of them in the end, so I was absolutely delighted, both males and females, and I learned how to listen for the song as well. That's one of the best ways to find them. He's an absolute expert, and I had the great pleasure of speaking with him at an altitude of about 1800 metres in pristine pine forest where the air was beautifully clear.
Hello, good morning. My name is Guillermo Bernal, and I am an official guide in the Canary Islands, specialized in natural history and archaeology. More specifically, I do most of my tours regarding bird watching, but also plants and insects. And
so, Guillermo, we are here in Gran Canaria, a place that I know that many of the listeners will be familiar with, but this isn't the Gran Canaria that I'm used to seeing on television. I'm not looking at the sand dunes at Maspalomas. I'm not looking at lots of people sunbathing on the beach. I'm not looking at people in restaurants or in big apartment buildings. You and I are high in the centre of this island. Probably looking at the clearest blue sky I've ever seen in my whole life, and that's because there are no clouds above us, because we're way above the clouds. It's wonderful and clear up here. We're in the middle of a pine forest. This is a very special place. Can you tell me a bit more about the habitat that we're in?
It's an endemic pine forest. It's an endemic species of pine that conforms this ecosystem. This ecosystem has evolved during thousands, probably millions of years, in a volcanic territory. So the pines can stand fire. They get burned if there's a fire, but they can reshoot green needles quite fast, in fact. And that's because in a volcanic eruption, you have the chances to have a wildfire, right? So it's like a natural adaptation. So it's quite a special tree. Also, the way the tree gets the water from the clouds, etc., is quite interesting. And we are just very close now to probably the most iconic monolith or rock in the island, which is called Roque Nublo, which is basically the geographical center of the island. So we are high above in the mountains, 1,800 meters, more or less, and in the geographical center of the island. And we are looking for blue chaffinches.
Well, yes, you mentioned the blue chaffinch. That's something that's really important here. When we're walking through this landscape, and you and I have been trekking around for the last couple of days in this pine forest, pretty much every life form we see here is unique to some extent. So the Canarian pine that you mentioned, it's only found, it's endemic or unique to the Canary Islands. You've shown me quite a few plants that are confined to Gran Canaria. You even showed me one plant yesterday which is confined to a particular ravine in Gran Canaria and found nowhere else on Earth. We're seeing things like Gran Canaria grayling, a butterfly found only on this island. The thing is, that's because these volcanic islands, they're hotbeds of endemism. Basically a laboratory for evolution. These islands, being volcanic, they've never been connected to a continental mainland. So the ancestors of all the plants and animals, so all the birds and insects and trees and flowers that we're seeing here, they somehow arrived on this island over a course of millions of years, and many things that would have arrived would have died and not survived. But those that did survive, found their niche, evolved into new species. It really is very remarkable. Maybe before we talk about the chaffinch, you could tell me a little bit about that endemism phenomenon.
I couldn't say it better, just because we are in a an isolated territory, just like so many other archipelagos in the world. There's a high degree of endemisms in the species that you can find here. We are speaking in the Canary Islands. We have around 20,000 different species of flora and fauna. Around 40% are endemic. Right? If we speak about plants, we have around 2,000 different taxons of plants and 500 are exclusive endemic to the Canaries. With the birds, is slightly different, and I think it's, again, something that happens in many archipelagos in the world. With the birds, you would not find a lot of different species of birds, but most of the ones that you find are at some degree endemic and unique, either to the Macaronesia area, or to the Canary Islands, or to this island in particular, right? So either if it's a subspecies or a full species, you would have some degree of endemism in the plants or in the birds or in the lizards that you see. Most likely, there are some nominal species, of course, but there's a high degree of endemisms in the island. Yeah.
I love birds, as listeners will well know, and one of the real treats for me has been seeing so many of the unique forms of bird that we have here. So a few moments ago, we saw a robin, and anybody coming from Ireland would see it and say, yeah, that's a robin. But when I saw it, I could see, but that's different. It's got less red down onto the belly, but that red is more intense. The robins we see in Ireland, it's more of an orange than a red. This was vividly red. A white ring around the eye, a very different song, a very different call. As we were walking along, we saw a bird that the people might not realize comes from here, the canary, named after these islands, a little member of the finch family. That's there. We saw a blue tit earlier. It was an African blue tit of a subspecies unique to Gran Canaria. Black on the head rather than blue. It hasn't got any white in its wings. It's amazing to see these different creatures around. It's even the kestrels that have been flying around. They're more speckled and with longer tails than the ones in Ireland. And there are two species of chaffinch in particular. So there's one here, the Canary Island chaffinch, which is found over quite a range of different habitats, relatively common species. It looks quite different to the ones in Ireland. It is a different species. But then there's another species again, and that's the one that you really specialise in working with. That's the Gran Canaria blue chaffinch, one of the rarest birds in the world. Yeah. Can you tell me a bit about the bird itself, what it looks like, the situation it was in, and the efforts that are underway to save it, to bring it back from the brink of extinction?
Absolutely. This bird is, as you mentioned, one of the rarest songbirds in the Western Palearctic. There was a time when we were speaking about the total population of Gran Canaria blue chaffinch was around 200 birds in the island of Gran Canaria. It was virtually extinct, as you mentioned, right? You could see that in the old Collins guidebook, right? And there was a big fire back in the beginning of the 2000s, and it affected the main nesting area. This is a bird that is exclusively linked to pine forest. You would not find it outside the pine forest ecosystem, right? So this forest was affected by a big wildfire in the beginning of the 2000s, 2005, if I'm not wrong. And local authorities thought, hey, it's a bird that lives here in Gran Canaria, basically nowhere else in the world. Back in that time, still was not split as full species. It was still considered a subspecies from the blue chaffinch in Tenerife. But local authorities said, okay, maybe we can do something to, you know, keep the population safe or alive or try to get some conservation program. So they came with this program trying to grow the numbers, and not just grow the numbers, create a backup nesting area so that if anything happens similar to that wildfire, the main or the only habitat was not fully affected and you can have a backup so that the birds could somehow survive. And they focused on those two lines. In the beginning, when they started breeding them in captivity to release them, it was not successful at all. There was a change in the program. So the breeding in captivity started working. There's a center close to the capital city in the island that is called El Pinzonario, where there's basically this captivity breeding for the blue chaffinches in the island. It's not working anymore because the conservation program finished like 4 years ago. Now what we are doing is monitoring the results of that conservation program to see how it went. So the second line, apart from growing the numbers with captivity breeding, it was finding a secondary breeding area for them. So they tried with a couple of pine forests apart from the main one. The first trial was again not successful, and the second area where they tried, which is this summit pine forest where we are right now, they looked like they liked the place and they started staying around, not coming back to their main nesting area, because also some of the birds in the main nesting area were captured and released in different pine zone areas to see if they liked to be there. In the beginning, most of them were just heading back to the original pine forest. They were not staying. But there was a point when some of them stayed where we are now. And the good thing is that there's a connection. They can go back if they want. There's a pine forest continuity, let's say, to join the two areas.
We can see the areas from each other quite easily certain points, so the birds can as well.
Yeah, correct. So it's good that they can go if they want, but they kind of stay here because of is their choice. So little by little, the new birds being released and the new backup area being found, well, the numbers grew up from 200 birds to 450, which, you know, 450 doesn't look like a lot, but in fact is more than double the population that the one that we started, right? So, yeah, definitely it worked. Now, as we mentioned, the conservation program is over. We are monitoring the results. No artificial feeders or no artificial drinking spots. Now they are on their own. Let's see how they do. Let's see how the numbers go up or go down. The reality is in these last 4 years, we went slightly down. The numbers in the secondary nesting area have been losing one or two pairs in the last years. Let's see if that is just this period of 4 years, and then maybe if we look in the long term, in 10, 15 years, maybe it goes up again, or maybe it really keeps going down slowly and we need to do something else. So that's what we are researching now.
That's certainly a very impressive result, to have more than doubled the population of this very rare bird in, as you said, the Western Palearctic, which is basically, it's the biogeographical region that covers Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, and includes the Macronesian Islands, which you also mentioned, which, just to explain what those are, that's the Canary Islands, Madeira, the Cape Verde Islands, and the Azores. And all of the same sort of volcanic origin over the course of millions of years, and all with unique but connected and related life forms across them. Now, you were talking there about the Gran Canaria blue chaffinch. Could you describe the bird for me, please?
Oh, yes. Gran Canaria blue chaffinch is considerably bigger than a common chaffinch, right? It's like one head bigger, let's say. Strong beak, still the same shape of the beak of a common chaffinch, but a bit stronger. And it's, believe it or not, it's not so blue as the blue color in a common chaffinch or Canary Island chaffinch, which is in fact very ultramarine blue, right? This Gran Canaria blue chaffinch is grayish blue, so it's like a, let's say, pastel color at some degrees. So it's not so intense dark blue, it's more grayish blue. The under part of the bird is more whitish. When you compare it to the Tenerife blue chaffinch is more intense blue and has less white overall in the bird. And is in fact slightly bigger than the one in Gran Canaria. Here, the bird is grayish blue, let's say, a bit more white in the belly, and definitely one of the main features is it has two white bands in the wing, right? In the shoulder, let's say. So you can also see that. And one of the criteria that was used to make the split, the two species, Gran Canaria blue chaffinch and Tenerife blue chaffinch, they were split in 2016. One of the criteria that were used, apart from the biometrics, was the vocalization, the voice. They sound different, to the point that there was some sort of a test where they were exposing females of one island to the songs of male of the other island. And there was no reaction. Females were not really, you know, attracted. So it was clear that the vocalizations were different. And it was used, again, as a criteria to split them. Yeah.
So the description that you gave, obviously, is of the adult male. Females often get overlooked. Can you just tell me what she looks like as well?
It's true. Sorry, poor females. Basically, females are slightly smaller, a couple of centimeters smaller in the wingspan, for instance. Super similar to a common chaffinch female in terms of that kind of brownish tones and colors. The difference with the Canary Island chaffinch or the common chaffinch in the females is that they are completely lacking the green in the rump or in the wings. So it's only brown and grayish colors, no green, absolutely, right? And again, it's smaller than the male, but it's still bigger than a male of the Canary Island chaffinch, right?
I was really excited when you showed me my first Gran Canaria blue chaffinches, both the male and the female. I could immediately see that they're big. They are much bigger than any finch really we would see in Ireland of any kind, not just the chaffinches. And that beak, that big strong beak for crushing seed, it is particularly strong looking and quite pointed and long as well. I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm assuming that's an adaptation to feeding on things like the seeds of the Canarian pine.
Correcto. It's a pine cone seeding. It's a part of the diet, most of the diet, in fact. Then when they are breeding, they can capture insects, etc. But they are adapted to get the seeds from the pine cones in these forests. Definitely, definitely.
Talking of breeding, can you tell me a bit about how they nest? How many chicks do they have? Do they have one or two broods?
Well, they nest almost in the top of the trees, right? The nests are not easy to find at all. Sometimes you just find the nest because you see the female going in with some material to build it and so on. And they are hard to find almost in the top of the pine trees, right? They start breeding from April, May, until the end of July, more or less. In August is completely over, the breeding season. You will have all the chicks around and so on. But they can have like two hatches, right? Mm-hmm. They can have like two turns.
Two broods per year.
Two birds, yes. And in any of those two hatching turns, they would have up to two eggs, right? So you don't really get much more than, like, the most successful you can get is around four birds. If you get two or one per season, that is something that is possible.
That's very low for a finch, and presumably that is one of the factors behind why it's been so hard for this species to increase its numbers over the years, that they have such a low reproductive rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing is that the habitat is not super extensive in the island. For instance, when you think about the blue chaffinch in Tenerife, they have around 10,000 blue chaffinches in Tenerife, which is a lot. And the thing is that there's way more pine forest habitat available in Tenerife, just because the island is bigger, right? So it's the way it is. So Gran Canaria is much smaller, despite being called Gran Canaria, it's smaller than Tenerife. So there's less pine forest available. And not just that, up to the 50s, and you saw some pictures yesterday, the center of the island was absolutely devastated. There was almost no pines at all. So there was a huge, intense cutting of the pine forest in the center of Gran Canaria, which really didn't help for the numbers to grow. That, along with the collectionism, let's say, of the first naturalists when the bird was classified or discovered, let's say, in the 1800s, that really made the numbers go down. And now we're trying to, you know, grow the numbers. But I guess it's like everything. When you start from small numbers, it takes its time to pick up the pace and then grow up. And then probably it will be a bit easier. But always with any species, when you have a conservation program, when you have small populations, it's super critical at the beginning, right? Because any disease, any storm, anything bad that would happen to that population, even if it kills like 10 birds, the percentage of loss is huge, right? So now we are kind of getting into a more comfortable area, but still there's work to be done to see how they do. Yeah, but it takes its time. Yeah, it takes its time.
What really brought that home to me when earlier we saw four Gran Canaria blue chaffinches and you pointed out that I'd just seen 1% of the world population. That's a really sobering thought.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That's something I used to say. When we are lucky enough to see four in one day, I always say you've seen 1% of the world population. Usually when we go bird watching, it takes, let's say, an average of around 2 hours to find one proper view. Like sometimes it's a glimpse or sometimes it's just a bird flying by. But, you know, to find one that you really enjoy the view and you have it in your binos for a few seconds at least, it's a couple of hours, depending on the time of the year, of course. Winter, they remain very silent. So it takes longer to scan the areas, the territories where they are usually around to find them. In the breeding season, as we are doing today, they are more vocal, so it's easier to track them. I use a lot my hearing right? They are so few, and the pine forest is so thick and extends that it's almost impossible. If you try to look for them only with your eyes, it's almost impossible. You have to be familiar with how they sound, try to track where they are coming from, where the sound is coming from, etc. Yeah, sometimes it takes 2 hours. Sometimes you just park the car and they are singing and it's 2 minutes, right? But it's part of the excitement of finding these species. So yesterday we were lucky and we could see four. Yeah, yeah.
Do we have any idea how this chaffinch or its ancestors got to this island? How long have they been here? And why are they not on some of the other islands like La Palma, which has extensive pine forest?
It's super interesting that you point that. Why in El Hierro or La Palma, which are the other two islands in the Canary Island archipelago where you can find pine forest, you don't get blue chaffinches? It's very curious. In La Palma, for instance, you don't get woodpeckers, right?
And we're surrounded by, again, a unique Canary Islands form of great spotted woodpecker.
Correcto. You have a lot of great spotted woodpeckers. Yesterday we saw a lot of them. And you go to La Palma and there's no woodpeckers in the pine forest there. So yeah, the pattern of distribution of some of these species, it's very curious. There's a gecko that is present in Gran Canaria, and the next island where you find it is two islands more to the west, which is El Hierro. So this gecko is not present in Tenerife, it's not present in La Gomera, it's only present Gran Canaria, then it skips two islands, and then El Hierro. So it's super interesting to see these patterns, how they organize themselves, how it's probably just a random arriving of floating elements. With the birds is different, because the birds, of course, they can fly and go to the other islands. But it's curious. There's no research that I know about to really point out the reasons for that. It's very interesting.
It's particularly interesting, I think, in relation to something like Tenerife, because we can see it from where we are right now. Mm-hmm. This massive volcano, this huge mountain called Teide in the middle of Tenerife, and the birds can see it as well. But yet the blue chaffinches from Gran Canaria never cross to Tenerife, and vice versa. You mentioned the island of La Palma there. It may not have blue chaffinches or woodpeckers. What it does have is a very healthy population of choughs, one of Derek's favourite birds, I know. We speak about them a lot on Mooney Goes Wild. They can see this massive volcano in just across the water in Tenerife, but they don't colonize there either.
No, that's so curious. And the evidence that there is no exchange of blue chaffinches going from Gran Canaria to Tenerife or vice versa is that you have two different species, right? They are not mixing. They are, in fact, splitting. They are getting more different than anything else. And those choughs in La Palma, only in La Palma, nowhere else. Not in Tenerife, not in La Gomera. And as you say, their birds is visible. The land is there, but there's no evidence that they keep moving. Like, for instance, choughs in La Palma, if I'm not wrong, they arrived there in a natural way. If I'm not wrong, but like so many other different species, the common ancestor for the blue chaffinch in the islands is, of course, the common chaffinch, that is now Canary Island chaffinch, the recent split as we mentioned. But they had to arrive from Africa. Right, from the northwest of the African coast, and from there they just found their place and they just stayed there, and probably they just it was not worth for them to keep investing energy in moving. There's a very, very clear example of that with the Canary Island chiffchaff. First thing you said when you saw the Canary Island chiffchaff yesterday was, oh, short wings, right?
Yes, absolutely.
That's the first thing you pointed out. Oh, look at those short wings. Canary Island chiffchaff, you know, chiffchaffs can migrate like thousands.
The ones we have in Ireland do. They migrate down to the Mediterranean, North Africa, that kind of region, yes.
Thousands of kilometres, right? Tiny, tiny little birds and covering those distances. Well, probably the ancestor of the Canary Island chiffchaff was arriving here in some sort of a migration, or diverted because of some storm or easterly winds coming from the Sahara or any of these episodes. But they arrived here. They stopped migrating. They stayed here. Probably they found resources enough all year round. There was no need for migration because the temperature in these islands is very consistent as long as you stay close to the coast all year round. When you come up here into the mountains where we are now, in winter is winter, and in fact it can snow, and in summer it can be hot. But close to the coast is very steady, eternal spring, let's say, right? So probably these chiffchaffs, they found resources enough all year round, and they stopped migrating, and that led little by little, by evolution, to the shortening of the wingspan, because there was no need to travel long distances. Mm-hmm. And they evolved to the point that they are now one endemic species here, the Canary Island chiffchaff, right? So that's a good example of that.
Do most people on the island here know about the Gran Canaria blue chaffinch? Is it something that people are proud of? Is it something that local people are interested in seeing? Do kids learn about it in school?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. And the short answer is yes. Yes, people are aware that we have this unique species, this Gran Canaria blue chaffinch. And that's because there has been an environmental teaching program and actions towards it. There has been environmental education lectures in schools and even in associations with adults and so on, schools with children, etc. And it was part of the conservation program, right? But also some other associations, like the equivalent of Birdwatch Island in Spain, which is the SEO BirdLife, they have been making people know about this blue chaffinch. So SEO BirdLife is the trust that is, in fact, hiring me and my colleagues. We are five in the team, because there are some ringers coming later in August, right? But SEO BirdLife is the one coordinating the works with the local authorities, let's say, right? So yeah, they're part of the conservation program, involves speaking, having lectures in schools and associations, etc., speaking about the blue chaffinch, making people know about the bird. There's even a company that I know that they make these young children songs, you know, for mm-hmm. TV, like if it was like, let's say, the Teletubbies or something like that, but with iconic elements from the Canary Islands, including the blue chaffinch, for instance. So it's interesting.
Well, I want to say thank you personally for showing me my first ever Gran Canaria blue chaffinches. It's actually a dream of mine to have seen this bird. Mm-hmm. When I was a teenager, I thought that it would be impossible ever to see this species. I thought that it would be gone by the time I would get a chance. It seemed like it was absolutely doomed. And the fact that you and your colleagues have been able to bring this species back from the brink of extinction, I think it gives us a lot of hope that nature, if given a chance and given proper investment and given passionate, dedicated people like yourself to do the work, it can be brought back, it can survive. It's never too late. Don't give up hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I'm very happy to hear that. I'm very happy to hear that you were so happy to see the blue chaffinch. Yeah, definitely. That's better than any reward. When you see, when I saw your face and your reaction with the first one, that was very, very good.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for coming and showing that interest. And thank you to your listeners for paying attention to all of these topics. Yeah, thank you so much.
You know, the sound of it is absolutely lovely, isn't it? Not terribly unlike our own chaffinch, is it?
Yes, people who listen to our Dawn Chorus programme each year in May will be familiar with the song of the chaffinch, one of the commonest birds in Ireland, and the sound of spring in Ireland, as far as I'm concerned, you hear them everywhere. It's similar, but it's a more, I suppose it's short, it's a shorter song, and it's not so abrupt in its transitions between the notes. It sort of gradually descends rather than going abruptly down in steps. You can tell it's related to the chaffinch, certainly, but it is different.
Anyway, if you find yourself in Gran Canaria, how high have they got to go?
You have to go pretty high. You have to go, it's around 1700, 1800 metres. To be honest, if you just wander around trying to find it, you may not. It's in very precise locations, so I would seek some expert help there.
All right, that's wonderful. More details, and you can have a look at a picture on our website, rte.ie/Munee. Let's say hello now to Terry Flanagan with the bank holiday and all that kind of stuff, reporting from Photo Wildlife Park. Terence, busy man.
Yes, Derek, I must say you are working me very, very hard. I'm here in Photo Wildlife Park, and you'll remember a couple of weeks ago we met with the three Asian lion cubs. They're just born, they're beautiful animals, they're causing great excitement here in the park. Today I'm with Aileen Tennant. Aileen is the new director of Photo Wildlife Park. Aileen, congratulations on your appointment.
Thank you very much, Terry.
What does a director do?
Well, good question. I'm learning all the ropes at the moment.
Yeah.
I have the privilege this week of going out with some of the teams to learn a little bit more about the work they do and to meet with some of the animals. A pretty special thing to do.
Yeah. Now, Photo is a fantastic place. It's 40 years old last year, and you're getting huge numbers of visitors in. I think almost 500,000 a year.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a brilliant day out for families. Even in the rainy day, I'd advise everybody to get down here and enjoy the beautiful surroundings that is Photo Wildlife Park.
What's the difference between a zoo and a wildlife park?
So I guess traditionally a zoo is a place that is developed in an urban environment. So it's normally you think of places like London Zoo, Dublin Zoo. They all originated in big built up urban areas. Wildlife parks, on the other hand, have a lot more space. So you might see larger groupings of animals in them. And I suppose in Foto Wildlife Park, we're also very special here because we have free roaming animals moving around the place, such as wallabies and kangaroos. So pretty special.
Yeah. And even larger animals like the giraffes and that, they come very, very close to you. Just see them. They're very much at home here.
Very much at home, very much displaying, you know, their natural behaviours as they would in the wild. It's amazing to see them feed and also to see things like, you know, their tongue reaching out to strip off the brows and see the lovely purple colouring. So, yeah, we were very fortunate to get to see them up close.
And you've been very successful in breeding giraffes here. I think you've had something over 70 of them.
Yes, I suppose, again, back to the keepers and rangers that are at work here. They're experts in understanding about giraffes and working internationally with other zoos and wildlife parks to breed the animals to make sure.
And it's not just the giraffes. You have things like cheetah as well and bison as well. Why is Foto so successful at breeding animals?
Again, back to the expert care from the rangers. They really know what they're doing. They work as part of, as I was mentioning, of an international community to identify, I suppose, the genetics of the species and look at ways to increase the genetic pool of the species around Europe and around the world.
What's the most successful breeding program you've had here?
The cheetahs have to be some of the most successful breeding programs of, I suppose, what we say is exotic animals. But I'm really, really proud, I suppose, of all of the native species work that takes place here, such as the reintroductions of natterjack toads, so just starting programs here for the natterjacks and the curlews. And that's a really special thing that we're working in conservation, not just on, you know, exotic species, but the species on our doorstep.
Now, you and I have something in common. It's not just our good looks. We're both ex-secondary science teachers. And I know you were heavily involved in transition year when you were a teacher.
Absolutely. So I'm a nature girl from Carlow. And when I was younger, I was loved animals and wildlife. I said, how will I move into a career where I can be involved in this? So I trained to be a science teacher. I was a teacher for 10 years. And I suppose during my time as a science teacher, I loved working with teenagers, but especially loved transition years. I did an awful lot of work in the area around conservation, environmental science. We ran school gardens. I worked with NGOs in sub-Saharan Africa on sustainable development. So my passion's always been in the environment and working with people.
And I know, for instance, when I was teaching, particularly with transition years, it's the 1 year group you've got the chance to do whatever you really want to do with them. And if you want to teach them about wildlife or nature or the environment, it's an ideal place, because with the Leaving Cert biology, you're kind of tied. You can't always do what you want to do. You're tied to a syllabus. With the transition year, you've got a blank canvas, so to speak.
Absolutely. It's such an opportunity to engage transition year students or young people with wildlife, with nature, and help them understand what they can do to help support species both in Ireland and abroad, and just to do things outside of the usual curriculum. Yeah. It's really a special moment, and I encourage all teachers to harness that. And I also encourage all teachers to bring their students to Foto Wildlife Park, because we've just opened a brand new education, conservation and research centre. And this year we had about 20,000 students come through, and many of those students are transition years. We do fantastic transition year programmes here at Foto Wildlife Park.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's another strand. So apart from people just coming in to see the animals, you have then your breeding programme and you have your education programme. So the three of them really run side by side.
Absolutely. Conservation is about breeding programmes, but more importantly, it's about people. And we really do need to educate people on how to conserve and preserve species and biodiversity globally. So education really is the, I suppose, the vehicle to help us all conserve species globally.
Now, as we walked around here today, as you said, it's very, very open. The animals, they look so relaxed. With these open enclosures, do the animals ever escape?
Actually, it's funny you say that, because one of the rangers told me that last week a visitor ran up to them talking about there's an animal escaped from its habitat. And he got very perplexed and he went and checked out. And he said, oh, no, that's a kangaroo. Kangaroos free roam around the park. So actually it was in its own habitat here. The whole park is its habitat.
But do you worry with some of the other animals maybe escape?
No, I suppose the procedures that the rangers have here, they, you know, make sure that the animals are kept as absolutely safe as possible. That's paramount to all the work that we do here. So
What's your favourite animal here?
Oh, every week it changes. I think this week is the lions because of the beautiful cubs that have been born. One of my favourites is also the rhinos. I have a very special place in my heart for rhinos.
Now, the other thing you have here as well, it's not just about the animals that are on view. You have special weekends. I think you have a bug bonanza weekend coming up and a native species weekend. Tell us a little bit about them.
So, yes, public engagement is such a big part of what we do. And again, in our brand new Education, Research and Conservation Centre, we have these public engagement weekends. So we have Native Species Weekend, where we work with many Irish conservation partners, and we delivering lots of fun, engaging learning activities towards the end of July. And then in August, on one of the weekends, we have the Bug Bonanza, and the educators here, the amazing educators at FOTA, will be doing different workshops with families. Mm.
Aileen, congratulations. Richard here. Now, it seems to me that the highest calling of a zoo is not just to raise animals in the zoo, but to restore them to the wild. And FOTA has been very distinguished in that regard. Things like the European bison, the scimitar horn, oryx. These are huge achievements for a zoo in Cork, so far from Tunisia and so far from Eastern Europe. Can we expect further developments on that front now that you're in charge?
Great question. And yes, I suppose one of the keen interests I have is obviously to try and reintroduce as many wild species into the wild. The success stories with the European bison, with the scimitar horned oryx is the beginning of it. We really rely on zoo science and research, which I hope to establish here as well in FOTA Wildlife Park, to help develop our breeding programmes and result, I suppose, or help those to result in reintroduction programmes for the wild.
And you have cheetahs outside your windows. I remember them when I used to visit FOTA. The cheetah would come right up and look in at you, sort of thing. And you have bred an awful lot of them. Have they gone back into the wild in Persia? And do you retain the stud book holding for that particular subspecies?
Yes, so we retained the stud book for the northern African cheetah. So Sean is continuing with that work, which is the stud book keeper work is a voluntary role and it really takes a lot of commitment. And the plan will be to continue to try and look at reintroductions in different parts of Africa and Asia into the future.
And Aileen, you mentioned Sean in relation to the voluntary position looking after the stud book for the cheetahs. Sean is Sean McKeown, who was the former director of FOTA Wildlife Park, and he stepped down recently and you've replaced him. And we just want to say the very best of luck and best wishes to Sean McKeown in his retirement. Although it doesn't sound like he's retired at all if he's continuing on with the stud book.
No, I think Sean will forever have his heart in conservation and I'm sure he'll be doing lots of big and great things with cheetahs going forward and other wildlife. He's a true conservationist.
Well, Aileen, it's lovely to meet you and it's lovely for everybody to go and meet the animals. So you know where it is, FOTA Wildlife Park in Cork. If you happen to find yourself down that part of the world over the summer, go in. Terry, thank you very much indeed. And thank you, Aileen.
Thank you, Derek.
The delightful sound of an egg frying in a hot pan. We Irish love eggs. As a nation, we consume hundreds of millions of them each year. For many, it's the perfect way to start the day.
How do you like your eggs in the morning?
If you were listening to RTE Radio 1 this afternoon at 3 p.m, you would have heard another documentary in our Nature on One series presented by Niall Hatch. Niall is dominating the programme today. It was all about eggs, not about frying them and boiling them and eating them. It was more about the evolution of eggs. Where do they come from? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Why are they shaped the way they are? And why do some birds lay one egg while others can lay as many as 16?
What you're asking relates to what's called Lack's hypothesis. David Lack was the 20th century's greatest ornithologist. And I was fortunate to have him as my supervisor, at least for a few months before he unfortunately died. And Lack's main research interest was precisely the question that you're asking. Why do some birds lay one egg, whereas something like blue tits lay 15 or 16 eggs? And the answer is that birds are designed by natural selection to produce the maximum number of offspring that they are capable of doing, which is usually determined by the food supply available to the chicks. Something like a great auk, which we have an egg here, they just laid one egg. That is because the food that that great auk chick needed was a long way out to sea, and the maximum number of chicks that a great auk could safely rear was one. If you're a blue tit living in a bit of oak woodland surrounded by caterpillars on the oak leaves, you can easily raise 12, 13, 14, 15 chicks. And so each species has evolved a reproductive rate that maximises its output. So that's why you have differences between species in the number of eggs that they lay.
You mentioned blue tits there. Now, the subject that comes up is calcium. Mm-hmm. If you lay one egg, you will get by on the minimum amount of calcium that you need to collect for the egg. Whereas if you're going to lay 10 or 12 eggs, you're going to have an awful lot of calcium to collect. And calcium is a sort of scarce commodity, I gather, in birds generally. Doesn't this offset the advantages of, or does it?
I think if birds had been incapable of finding enough calcium to produce 16 eggs in blue tit's case, then it wouldn't have evolved. In something like a seabird, like a guillemot or a great auk, they're digesting fish and digesting all the bones. There's no shortage of calcium. And in fact, these two species, great auk and guillemot, lay the thickest shell relative to egg size of any bird species. That's because the egg is laid on a bare rock surface and it gets knocked around a lot, so it has to be very robust. If you're a blue tit looking to produce the calcium for a clutch of 16, you have to find snail shells or some other similar source of calcium. And they seem to be very good at that. And one of the questions I pose in my book is, how do birds find calcium? And I've asked calcium physiologists this question: can you smell calcium? And I think perhaps you can. I mean, it would be a very easy thing to test in captivity. You know, you just hide calcium at the time when birds need it in little boxes, and some would be controls and some would be experimental with the calcium in there, and you could tell whether the bird was capable of smelling it. Certainly if you kept birds in captivity during the breeding season, they have an appetite, a real appetite for calcium right at the time when they're forming the shell. And what something like a blue tit would do would be to go around on the woodland floor, find broken snail shells or sometimes fragments of bone, and they pack their gullet with calcium the night before they're producing the egg, because the shell would then be made the next day.
Calcium carbonate is white. White eggs are fine if you're a bird which lays them deep within a burrow, as the puffin and shelduck do, for example, where they're safe from prying predatory eyes. These species have never been under any evolutionary pressure to produce eggs of any other colour than white. It would make no difference to their chances of survival. For birds whose nests are more open and visible to potential predators, however, such as most passerines or songbirds, white eggs would be a major liability, sticking out like sore thumbs. The pressures of natural selection have led many of these species to add camouflaging pigmentation to the exteriors of their eggs, with the basic white coloration of the calcium carbonate shells being anointed with a dazzling array of different hues, from browns to reds to greens and even to blues. Essentially, the female uses pigmentation glands to spray paint these colours onto her eggs while they are still inside her oviduct. Not only can these added colours and patterns give camouflage to the eggs, they can also help the parents to identify them, something that comes in particularly handy when birds are nesting at high densities in large colonies, as many seabirds do. A case in point is the guillemot. These penguin-like brown and white seabirds nest on narrow cliff ledges around the coasts of the North Atlantic, including here in Ireland, often in tens of thousands. Being able to recognise your own egg in the midst of such vast colonies is an essential skill, which is why guillemot eggs tend to look so different from one another. The array of different colours and patterns is simply staggering.
Absolutely fantastic stuff. In that clip there, you heard our own Dr. Richard Collins speaking with Professor Tim Burkhead, and it was finished off by Niall explaining how birds' eggs get their distinctive colours. If you'd like to listen back to that documentary about birds' eggs, you can do so by visiting our website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's all we have time for tonight. My thanks to our broadcast coordinator, Daniel Keating. Until next time, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye!